You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 19th of August 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tyler Brûlé. On today's show...
Sometimes, in the heat of debate and speaking on a multitude of issues, you don't choose the right words or you say the wrong thing.
A change of tactic on Donald Trump's campaign as he reshuffles his team once again and Hillary Clinton launches a podcast. I'm joined by our editor, Andrew Tuck, and our executive producer, Tom Edwards, to measure the temperature of the race to the White House. Then we'll be asking, when is diplomatic immunity taken too far? And as the most anticipated Olympics come to an end, we see if Rio has lived up to the task. All that and more coming up here on Midori House with me, Tyler Brûlé, here on Monocle 24. And it is just 1,824 seconds, roughly. Andrew Tuck has scampered down to the studio, and Tom Edwards is just alongside me. And I know we were talking at the top of the program about, measuring the temperature. It's rather cold in here.
It is. It's bracing, though. Good for the brain, as I understand it, Tyler.
I can tell just looking in the front of your tight chambray top that it's toast. It's less than toasty in here.
You have to give the people what they want, Tyler.
You do indeed. How are you, gentlemen? It's been a while.
Yeah, it has been a while. You've been on the road.
We've been on the road because I saw you in. I did see you in Hong Kong 10 days ago.
Yeah, 10 days ago. Short and sweet. I felt that I'd lingered because I'd been there 2 days. You were there about 6 hours, I think.
I know, and we have not fully unpacked my adventure to the Chinese capital, have we?
No, then on you went to Beijing.
On I went to Beijing. Tom Edwards, have you been to Beijing?
I haven't had the pleasure.
I've been for you, no.
Okay. Right. So you're suggesting I should just... chalk that one off and move on.
We've done it. But we can discuss that on another program.
A former Olympic host city, of course.
Indeed.
Though. And we're going to be touching upon that, I think, later in the show.
I think that was a wonderful...
Elegantly done.
Well done.
You've done this before.
Yeah, I try my best.
I can see. Andrew, we are just about to embark on our October issue, are we not?
Well, I think we're well embarked.
Well, yeah, we are well embarked. Yeah, we're actually coming back to port.
Yes, we're coming back to port. and it's actually going very well, despite the fact that I think everybody seems to have taken this week off on their holidays.
Yeah, and it's going to go even better because I know it's production week next week.
Yes, you do now.
Andrew almost listened. Tom, I missed you yesterday when I came into the office. But, I thought that production week was not next week, it was the week after.
No one told my office. Don't forget, I'm not here next week. Oh, you're not doing production week.
Anyway,
lots of calls to JAL, I think, and ANA in the last few hours.
Absolutely. You were saying actually at the top that it's quite exciting because we're not just us gentlemen around the table today, but we're also going to be talking to some of our other capable correspondents, are we not?
Exactly. We'll loop them in from around the globe, wherever they are, scattered hither and thither, taking a break from their reporting and writing assignments to check in with us and give us their thoughts on some of the big stories of the day, Tyler.
Well, should we start off in the United States?
Let's do that.
Should we do that? It's been another tough week for the Republicans after a major drop in the polls. Donald Trump announced yet another campaign reshuffle, placing Stephen Bannon, the head of Breitbart News, as the CEO of his campaign. And today's former campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, resigned just 2 months after taking up the job. Bit of a tough gig, isn't it?
Well, I was going to think, is it the job nobody wants? What is interesting, he's shuffling. Is this a rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic job? There's been a real shift. Even, 4 or 5 weeks ago, there was still the sense that maybe somehow Trump could win. It's looking increasingly unlikely, and I wonder whether personnel changes is merely sort of, scratching at the surface of the problems that he faces now.
I did hear a Republican this morning describe him on another media outlet, describe him as a dumpster fire, which I... which I thought was oddly...
I'll sign up to that.
Rather descriptive of what's going on. You do get the sense, and there have been these hints. It's been claimed, Michael Moore claims, he knows for a fact that Trump doesn't want to win and he's been doing it to kind of win a bigger TV deal. I think that notion of the Michael Moore conspiracy theory maybe I'm not quite convinced by, but you do get the sense he's kind of having fun now. I don't know if he's that convinced he's going to win, and he has hinted in some of his speeches that he's aware that he might be having some extra time after November. I think he's just doing what he wants to do, and he doesn't care who's around him or what he's doing.
But I just wonder, would someone like that, with that kind of ego, people suggesting a narcissistic personality, whatever, would he stroll onward into a heavy, heavy defeat at the ballot boxes? Because that is his nation's public squarely saying, no, you're not for us. And I just wonder whether somebody with an ego that big, who's clearly so brittle in terms of the robustness of his character, might you just say, do you know what, I don't need this, and walk away? And I've been laughed out of rooms for mooting that, but I wouldn't be entirely surprised if he's not here come November 8th.
You're posing very big questions, and that, of course, demands a big answer. Should we go to Toronto?
Let's do it.
We should go to Toronto. Our Thomas Lewis, our bureau chief, is there. You heard what your colleague, Tom Edwards, was saying. What's the answer to that? And also, what is the mood on your side of the border, indeed your side of the Atlantic, Thomas?
Well, I think the mood here, I mean, is still one of scratching heads, frankly, as every, you know, new sort of outrageous statements comes forth. I think all of this sort of reshuffling and resignations and things, though, for the Trump camp, I genuinely think that people just don't know what the effect of any of this is going to be. You know, Trump has sort of ditched all the traditional political rules of a presidential campaign so far, and it does seem to be working for him. I mean, I think, you know, I was at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia a couple of weeks ago, and I spoke to a political advertiser there who kind of, you know, urged a bit of caution about these people that were saying, well, look, it's going to be a really close thing, you know, it'll be a tough job for Hillary to win. And he said, well, look, all Trump's got so far is a string of, you know, no doubt resounding primary election victories. But he said that those pools of the electorate are traditionally very different to a national general election electorate, if you like. So, you know, he seemed fairly comfortable that Hillary would win. I mean, I think though, Hillary Clinton is not being complacent at all. She knows that it is a really tough fight for her, and that these niggles about her, this apparent sort of distance that people feel, I really don't think she's still been able to shake that off. So she knows that, you know, this is definitely not a given. And if people decide, for example, to stay at home on election day, well, actually, Trump could probably win if you look at the maths of it.
Thomas, just on the note of distance, and I know you're in one of our far-flung bureaus, but the wine just came into the studio right now, and there was even a glass poured for you.
Yeah, strangely, four glasses came in. I'm not sure what was
that. But Andrew already knocked one back. So
I think it's a little bit like when, you know, we expect the reindeer. We're going to put one outside the door and see if you kind of turn up.
Anyway,
I'm glad you found a good home, Andrew.
It's only coming up to 1308, so you can't have that glass yet in Toronto, but it is indeed about to be 1808 here in London. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tyler Brûlé, Andrew Tuck, Tom Edwards, and Thomas Lewis. Is in Toronto. Should we just, there's been a lot of, anyone who woke up, on either side of the Atlantic, a lot of front pages, and of course, certainly no shortage of video and audio clips of this Trump apology. Let's have a little listen. We'll come back to you in a second, Thomas.
Sometimes in the heat of debate and speaking on a multitude of issues, you don't choose the right words or you say the wrong thing. I have done that. And believe it or not, I regret it. And I do regret it, particularly where it may have caused personal pain. Too much is at stake for us to be consumed with these issues.
I think we know who that was speaking there. Andrew, if I look at this, we were talking a few minutes ago about just the revolving door of really of executives who've been at the top of this campaign. Trump likes to talk of course, of being this very successful businessman. You know, if you were a shareholder and you saw this going on when he speaks of business, if this was a corporation, you aside from dumpsters, I mean, you'd be dumping your shares as well.
Well, the amazing thing is we know, for example, that when he called for no Muslims to be allowed to enter the United States for the time being while they sorted out who these people really were, we know he has big investments in the Middle East. He's somebody who really just doesn't care what he says or what he says about even the people who invest in his business and who generate income for him. He won't reveal his tax returns. Many people feel that would show either he pays zero or close to zero in tax. Meanwhile, we saw Hillary reviewing her tax returns, showing actually quite the opposite. She's done her best to pay tax. We just know that he doesn't really care about any of those constituent parts. And again, when you hear him, if he was a comedian, he'd actually be quite funny. He's good at, you know, he always goes for the punchline. He knows how to whip up a crowd, but he has no momentum. And it's interesting, Sasha Isenberg, who is our Washington correspondent, we were talking to him about this, and he was saying what's interesting is, you know, that in a way, you know, he has the outward showings of an autocrat, but actually when it comes down to it, he has none of the energy that you need to be an autocrat, because he's kind of, he whips up all these, you know, rivalries with people, and he's kind of forgotten them the next morning. He can't even remember who he's fallen out with.
Thomas in Toronto, just give us the view from the Canadian side. I mean, when we looked at this, whether it's the apology, how much airtime is the Canadian press giving to this? And just what is the mood on that side of the border? We have so many stories swirling around about how to get a Canadian passport if you're living Vermont or California. How's it playing as we're, you know, really well under the 100-day mark now?
Well, yes. I mean, it's playing pretty heavily, as you'd expect. And as I think, you know, US general elections usually do here, you know, this is a country that is inextricably bound to its neighbour to the south, both economically, both culturally to a certain degree. And I think, you know, the Trump sort of phenomenon, if you like, is something that, as I said before, you know, people here are definitely scratching their heads over. And I think, to be honest, are pretty nervous about. I mean, I think when you look at the election here in Canada at the end of last year, you know, that's obviously, this is a three-party parliamentary system here, so the comparison maybe doesn't quite work. But, you know, this was a place where it looked like that, you know, the political mood was splintering quite hard to both the right and the left. But actually, it was the middle ground, the Liberal Party, that won the day. So I think there's kind of a slight concern that this banking to the right and the left is happening pretty hard in the US. And I think there is a bit of nervousness, actually, about what exactly in reality that might mean, whoever wins, frankly, actually come the election in November.
Thomas, it's funny to imagine even like Trudeau and Trump up at, you know, say Camp David. What would that weekend be like?
well, goodness knows, frankly. I'm sure golden platters of whatever. You know, I don't know.
We're going to move on to discussions around things diplomatic in a moment. But before I go as well, I just want to talk about a bit of moonlighting that I think Tom Edwards has been doing, because Hillary Clinton has a podcast now. I'm sort of wondering why we haven't been seeing you. Have you been in sort of the suburbs of, you know, you've been around Virginia, the environs around DC. I don't know what's been going on.
I wouldn't mind trying my hand. No, I've been glued to my desk here at Midori House.
Okay, very good.
Otherwise I would have headed over to help out.
A shrewd move, though. Something with the times makes sense. It strikes me as oddly, you know, not oddly, but also quite presidential, because we're used to, of course, the president addressing the nation on radio. So somehow sort of getting into people's ears seems rather interesting.
Well, no, this is exactly what I was going to say, and it actually goes back to some of the very founding principles of what Monocle 24 was about, which is about this idea of, you know, talking literally to people. And I think people, yeah, familiar with the fireside chats of presidents in times gone by. There is an undeniable immediacy, and it doesn't surprise me that Hillary Clinton, say what you like about how popular or unpopular she may be, she's politically astute, and I think it's a very sensible medium to exploit to communicate.
Did you have a listen? I did.
I haven't listened yet.
It's interesting. So it's called With Her. But it's interesting how all of those American podcasts now all sound like NPR. They're all in, they've got one flavour. So it starts off.
What is that flavour?
Well, it's kind of like a bit kind of, you know, you start with a quirky kind of question. Hey, what do I call you before we get started? Do I call you Hillary? What do I call you? You call me whatever you like. Yeah, so off we go in like a, it's got the tone. And there's even, I think, that a microphone they must use, or a way of recording it, that it sounds like serial. You don't know if she's going to be guilty of a murder in the end or not. But
everyone also sounds vaguely medicated too.
Yep. Yes, and it's just the editing of it. Everyone has obviously looked at two or three of these very successful podcasts, and they all sound exactly the same.
They need a bit of independent flair, don't they? give us a call.
Thomas, have you had a listen yet?
I haven't had a listen yet, but I think it is a really interesting idea. And if we were talking about this idea of distance for Hillary Clinton, you look at her campaign so far, she's really foregone the kind of, you know, big rallies, the huge screaming stadiums of supporters, those kind of things. And she's gone for these very small meetings in coffee shops, in schools, in various centres around the country. And I think this, the With Her podcast, sort of taps into that, you know, come on, get to know me, you know, have a listen. I am a human after all, that kind kind of thing. So I would imagine that that's kind of the political calculation with doing this.
Well, it's lunchtime in Toronto. You've got another 46 minutes before you have to be back at your desk to have a listen. Thomas Lewis, our bureau chief in Toronto, very good to talk to you. It's just gone 18:15 here in London. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tyler Brûlé, Andrew Tuck, and Tom Edwards. We should take things now down Portugal way and really sort of pose the question, when is diplomatic immunity taken a step too far? If you're in London and you follow the papers, I think the U.S. Embassy, Andrew, I think there's a discussion about a bill somewhere near the £10 million mark for just congestion charges, because if you've got diplomatic plates, supposedly you're immune. The Nigerians owing something like £40,000 in parking fees. In Portugal, this immunity granted to foreign diplomats is causing quite a stir there at the moment. The twin sons of Iraq's ambassador to the country have been arrested and subsequently freed under their father's immunity for attacking a 15-year-old boy. Quite extraordinary. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs says it is considering diplomatic action, but does that mean making the ambassador a persona non grata, the only way foreign diplomats can essentially be kicked out of the country? We've seen, of course, corporate culture rewritten. Many things have been overturned. Things, you know, certainly don't function around boardrooms the way they even did 10 years ago, 5 years ago. Swiss banking rules have been rewritten. We never thought that would happen. Do you think that a case like this really, I mean, aside from raising eyebrows, Andrew, you know, might say that, look, it doesn't matter whether you're a diplomat or not. Things like this don't fly, and particularly when it's even at slightly one remove, when it's your children as well.
I think that's the question. I think it becomes very difficult, even, you know, if an ambassador is accused of a crime, or somebody who's working in the mission is accused of a crime. I do feel that you don't really want to be played out in the local courts unless the home government agrees to allow that immunity to be waived. Because in the end, we know that many difficult political countries would take action and claim they were going after a criminal prosecution. But here we have the case of two young guys who, it seems, deliberately ran over a boy in a row. A 15-year-old boy has already had reconstructive surgery on his face, whose life seems to be hanging by a thread. And there, you would hope that the decent thing was done, that the Iraqi ambassador waived the immunity for his children and allowed them to go through the correct procedures. But you fear that that won't happen. And that's, I think it's in those areas where then you do have to question, why is immunity allowed to be passed on to children in this way? And certainly in this case, it seems the only decent thing to be done is for the ambassador to allow his children to face justice.
I mean, I go along with what Andrew says. I think it's a very complex issue. And the fear would be, if you did rein back on this, that it would be abused, you know, the other way around, with host countries looking to score political points or, you know, move potentially, you know, countries that were potentially in political opposition to them to wrong foot them by using this to their credit. I wonder whether there's a way of perhaps allowing due process to happen in a country. Maybe then there's agreements that extradition would follow back to the country of residence or something like that, some kind of halfway ground, because there are too many examples in history. There's plenty of them in this country and around the world of diplomats or embassies or crimes committed from within embassy buildings, where the perpetrators remain beyond the law, sometimes decades later.
And I wonder as well, is there an advantage if you're a Portugal? You're not an ally with, you know, it's not a case where you've got major Portuguese engineering companies with tens of billions of dollars in contract. There's not as many vested interests like it would be with many other allies. So does Portugal, Andrew, do you think also have an opportunity maybe to make a point? Because the vested interests are not there.
I think, one, they have an opportunity to make a point. And two, I think their demands for justice could be seen in a better light by everybody, even by the Iraqis, because it's not going to be seen to be part of the vested interest. If it was the UK saying it, who's allied with all sorts of people, or if it's some opposition, then you can see where people say, we're not getting involved, we're pulling our people out. But here, I think on both sides, there's an opportunity for this to work out in the correct way.
Well, Jim, we're going to leave it there, just coming up to 20 minutes past the hour. You are listening to Midori House with me, Tyler Brûlé, Andrew Tuck, and Tom Edwards. We're taking a very, very short break. When we come back, we'll be looking at the soft power of the Rio Olympics and talk about Kalashnikov's new bizarre souvenir shop in a Moscow airport. Stay with us.
Meet the Writers is the show in which we have a chance to get intimate with some exciting authors. Airing at 1500 every Saturday and available as a podcast thereafter, it's an in-depth discussion about the life and work of a different writer every week, with me, Georgina Godwin, on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House here in Studio One at Midori House here in London on Monocle 24.
But he straightens up a long way in front, the big man, running well, Alonso Edward, Bolters in front. We are witnessing history. The great champion adds to his legend. He wins the 200 and beats De Grasse.
Well, we are on the home stretch of the Rio Games, which come to a close this weekend. Certainly a lot of pressure for Brazil to perform well as a host nation. Andrew, we've been covering the run-up, but even before that, you know, if I look back at, 4 or 5 years ago, even the amount of crisscrossing we were doing, many of our colleagues, to this magical place called Brazil, there was the whole soft power story. And of course, things started to go in a very different direction. Almost at the moment we were at the countdown point, the four-year point, when, of course, the Olympic rings were handed over from London to Rio, things started to go terribly wrong for the country. Nevertheless, how do you think things have gone for them? We're into doing report cards. What kind of grade would you be giving to?
On the games, I'll give them 9 out of 10. I think it's been great for them. I think the wheels have come off the economy. They've gone through the indictment, the potential indictment of Dilma Rousseff, and everybody was, you know, starting this Olympic Games thinking the country was in a bad place. You know, security fears, and we'll come back to that, I know. But the games begin, and, you know, they have been a little bit messy. You know, the pool was the wrong colour one day. People booed and shouted, and I was watching the tennis. Most people seemed to have their tops off while they were watching it, and it was great. Do you know what? The Brazilians acted like Brazilians, and the locals, you know, the visitors rather, seemed to get involved with that. And, you know, it's kind of probably like some kind of one of those dial-up porn websites. When you go through to...
What are those?
Well, I'll show you later. When you go through to watching the Rio Olympics, there is this kind of gorgeous, voluptuous city on your TV screens all the time. And for branding, it's not like when you're in London where, you know, perhaps you kind of saw the Stratford Flats out the back of the shot. Here you're kind of seeing Ipanema, you're seeing the Christ the Redeemer. It just looks amazing.
We're going to go to New York in a moment. Our Ed Stalker, our bureau chief there, is in our bureau, hopefully, anyway. But just quickly, Tom Edwards, your take on it. So first, scoring it. 9 as well, or 8.5?
Yeah,
or?
definitely an 8. I think the sport has delivered, and ultimately, you know, that is what the Olympic Games are about. It's a sporting event first and foremost, and I think there have been some great narratives. You only had to listen to that little set of clips we played. That was the Brazilian announcer calling Brazil's first gold medal, which was itself a wonderful rags-to-riches story. I think it's delivered absolutely in sporting terms, and yeah, I think it's also been good for the nation to put on an event where it's been surprisingly crime-free, despite what some erroneous and potentially inebriated US swimmers might say. And it's been a really good advertisement. And maybe it can actually galvanise the country a little and show them, you know, take them back to that, you know, that more innocent time 4 or 5 years ago when there was all of that optimism to build on.
Well, let's ask our other man in the Americas, Ed Stalker in New York. How's it played out on NBC?
I mean, I think it's interesting. I mean, I think what you're saying is all true in the sense that from a branding point, I guess you can't argue. You know, Brazilians know how to put on a good show, and they haven't failed in that regard. And the sport, I guess, has spoken for itself. I think it's only when you, I guess, look behind all of that to some of the other things that I guess you see some of the more unsavory aspects. The fact that, you know, a few tricks had been missed. For example, all of the 17-story towers, all of the village, the Olympic Village, is going to be transformed into luxury condos. They could have perhaps done something else with all those buildings they constructed. I guess you can't have foreseen the political situation a few years ago when they won, but even so, that hasn't helped their brand. But I think perhaps at the end of the day, like you're all saying, the sport has managed to be the most dominant part, hopefully, of these Olympic Games.
Ed, I kind of agree with you. I don't think you see that during the Games. We know that before and after. And I think for Brazil, Ryan Lochte has just done the best thing for that nation in the last few days. He's kind of shown that the people who criticise that city are mainly lying idiots, and whose kind of, you know, honesty is even smaller than their swimming trunks. And lo and behold, you know, now everybody around the world thinks, oh my God, the poor Brazilians, these people hitting on them, lying. Mm. I think, in fact, the Ryan Lochte story is going to do more for brand Brazil in these last couple of days than anything else.
How has it also played out today? Because, I mean, obviously we know that, and we were talking about Mr. Trump in the beginning. I imagine this has already been a polarizing story on the US morning shows.
I mean, it's definitely, you know, tuning into public radio this morning. It was one of the first things on the radio. It's making headlines. Trump's still managing to dominate a lot as well, and the games themselves. But I think, just to go back to Andrew's point, that is interesting what you say. It shows that perhaps trying to tap into the cliche of Rio being crime-ridden has kind of backfired for these Americans, and perhaps done something for brand Brazil. But I would say still, a lot of problems below the surface in Brazil that are undeniable.
Tom, do you think that we're going to see an uptick from next week, 2 weeks out, last quarter of this year? Hey, this place looked pretty good. So whether people are giving it 8 out of 10, 9 out of 10, that we'll see an uptick in tourism. People think this is, you know, and it will do all of the legacy things one hopes that a Games are supposed to deliver.
It's got as good a shot as any recent Olympic Games that I can think of doing exactly that. It was funny, a couple of times, I haven't watched too much of it, but watching, for example, the rowing, the regatta, and, you know, to watch these boats describing their way through these incredible, see, okay, maybe there was a bit of effluent in there. You couldn't see that on the TV.
Yeah, of course.
But just the scenery, the backdrop, the light. And I think there was something about the warmth of the crowd. And I know some people, you know, the French pole vaulter and a few others have criticised the Brazilians for being too partisan and for getting too involved. But most people who enjoy sport, most people who watch these kind of events around the world, want to see some passion, a bit of vigour, a bit of enthusiasm. And I think that will have confirmed all those positive stereotypes about Brazil. And that can only be a good thing.
Ed, just before we go, will you be gathering around the television to watch the closing ceremonies?
I will indeed, Tyler.
Okay, well, that's an enthusiasm. Ed Stalker, New York, we're wishing you a very, very good weekend. Just before we go, I mentioned a little bit earlier in the program, gunmaker Kalashnikov has opened a souvenir shop at Moscow's Sheremetyevo Airport. Now, listen, we've, of course, seen, you know, many brand extensions. Probably Kalashnikov is one of the better-known brands known in the Russian Federation. Andrew, do you think there's any problem? I mean, Beretta has, you know, has gun shops around the world. If you were on your way out, would you want to sort of get a tea cozy or maybe some oven mitts from Kalashnikov?
Yeah, and let's remember that the Swiss like to try and pull an army knife on you as you go through a checkout as well. I don't think there's anything wrong with that, actually. I think, you know, especially in the Russian context, it'd probably just be seen as kind of as sweet as IKEA.
Mm. I mean, you have not really a newborn at the moment, but, you know, maybe a onesie or something like that.
I love AK-47 onesie. Right. I don't know. I've got to be honest. I probably slightly diverge from Andrew's view on this. I'm not sure that's the best place. I'm all for the brand extension. I think it makes sense. And if you're into that kind of thing, it's the brand in automatic rifle wear. Is an airport the best location? I maybe think that I might have picked a different.
And does it matter if it's before or after security?
That's a fair point. Did you see they've said, yes, we'll have replicas, but they'll be very clearly replicas, so there's nothing to worry about from a security viewpoint. It's like,
yeah,
I don't know. I think it's kind of playing with fire.
Can I just bring this back to Lisbon as well? I was buying something. I think I was buying wine at the airport, and it was extraordinary that I think there was some jamón, or is it jamón? Do you call it jamón? I'm talking to our producer in the background. I know. So what do you call it? We're just checking. Oh, presunto. Anyway, she was slicing some presunto in the duty-free shop. And she pulled out a knife as long as this table. I mean, it was like a meter long. And this is after security. Imagine what could have happened. So, I mean, that could have gone onto any aircraft. Anyway, security alert.
Maybe I'm just worrying too much.
Yeah, he's not, anyway. Tom Edwards, have a very good weekend. Andrew Tuck, same to you.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Midori House. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello. Researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Ximena Mignan, and Jakob Ledurner. Our studio manager has been Weidong Lin. More music next with Carlotta. Then at 1900, it's The Menu with Marcus Hippie. I'm Tyler Brulé. Have a very good weekend. I'm back with a very, very special and sparky edition of The Stack tomorrow. Goodbye.